I've spoken in a few places in the last few weeks, and I always began well because my fairy godmother, the Duchess Lillian Hellman, made up a feud with me about 2 months ago. And as is her fashion when she decides that she's no longer angry at you, like many a duchess before her, she sends you a joke. And she's not a renowned playwright for too little. Her jokes are always excellent. And I've used this one to preface readings for Ancient Evenings. It starts off, the occasion starts off splendidly because of this wonderful little joke, which goes like this. One New York cab driver is talking to another, and he says, "I don't know what's the matter with you. I just don't know how to talk to you anymore. You've gotten so affected. You don't drink beer with us anymore. You just go off into a corner in a cafeteria here. You bring in a little wine and a paper bag, and you nip from it while you read poetry to yourself. And I'm telling you, I don't like it. You're getting very affected." And the second cab driver says, "Who? Moi?" Well, that's a perfect way to begin a reading of Ancient Evenings. But since I'm not going to do that until Friday, I'll have to figure out a way to start on that occasion. The irony of the joke I've just offered is that it's not applicable for what I'm going to talk about today. The title is the, and I fear this is my title, The Problem of Writing, suffers from that marvelous desire of all title writers to be vehicle engineers. You know, one presents this huge title, The Problem of Writing, no less. And when I looked at it, I winced. I thought, once again, I've done it. It's a dreadful title. It's got to be reduced quickly. So let's say that what we'll talk about today are three aspects of the problem of writing. And since I think that a formal schedule is delightful for an audience because they can count the minutes before it's time for them to leave, they can say, yes, we've passed through Act 5 in an 8-act play, and so there are only 3 acts to go. Let me say that I will talk for a while about poetry, which is certainly one aspect of the problem of writing. And then I'm going to go on for a bit about the problem of the writer, particularly the novelist, in keeping it up, in writing from day to day. And then I will throw myself to you and answer all questions, particularly those that have some relation to what I've been talking about. After which, we will finish with an air from Scheherazade, and I will tell you about the that conference in France, which opened up the most interesting aspect of writing, which is the idea of the writer as the visionary. With these three aspects, we will not begin to deal with the problem of writing, if there is such a problem, but we will at least have made three approaches into the center of a most mysterious process. The older I get, the more I'm overcome with the mystery of the most everyday acts. And among these everyday acts, of course, for myself is writing. May I say, like acting, like painting, the arts have their most peculiar, almost sinister aspect when you live and work in them all the time. You begin to wonder how much of it is your own achievement and how much you serve as an agent for others. For instance, today at lunch we were talking about the deconstruction of deconstructionists, and it seemed to me that that firm but slightly hysterical tone that they use when they say, in effect, that the writer is not to be considered historically as the cause of his text. Rather, the text must be studied on its own and by itself. That if you take that one step deeper, you have to assume that the anxiety they feel is what they really are saying, and there may be a great deal to it, is that there are forces in the cosmos, demiurges, that seize upon given writers at given moments and just say, here, you be the agent for these ideas, because the cosmos wishes to present these ideas to the culture at this point. It's the German notion of the Geist. It's a powerful notion. It's one of the little anxieties that writers deal with. However, I throw this out merely as a prefatory remark to show you the peculiar character of any approach to the problem. A typical sentence for an existentialist to make. Now, years ago, on an occasion something like this, a young girl came up to me after it was over, or maybe it was during the question period, and she said, Mr. Mailer, what is a poem? And I pondered that and said to her, my dear child, it is impossible to answer you. Apparently, I thought I had made a major shift in my accent, but obviously it was just my overactive inner life. Or have I put many of you to sleep already? So I said to her, it's impossible to answer. You can't say what a poem is. And I went home and I pondered it. It's irritating to be asked a large question, a question that demands 1% from the questioner and 99% from yourself. But by the way, parenthetically, if you want to endear yourself to your teachers, try the opposite of that. It's all exchange of energy, as you'll see when we come to the end of this talk. But anyway, I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I finally decided that that you can't begin to say what a poem is until you can come to a firm conclusion about what is not a poem. Early in the 19th century, that was never a problem. A poem was something that rhymed. And if it had a little meter, that was even better. And that was the end of the matter. And if it didn't rhyme, it was prose. But then Ezra Pound came along. And Pound introduced some frightening notions into poetry. He said that, for one thing, that a poem should be at least as well written as good prose. And as a corollary of that, a poem should never be enslaved to a rhyme scheme, because a rhyme scheme tended to mutilate, warp, and torture the English that was used. And as a result, the literal writing of the poem was not as good as good prose. And then he went further. He said that even that a poem should not even have any more music than was implicit in the nature of the poem itself. And poetry and poets, particularly American poets, who were immensely influenced by Pound, began to go into so many directions that it became more and more difficult to determine where poetry ended and something else began. I'm going to give you some examples of that so that we can come a little closer to this matter, because it's a crucial and delicate matter. What is not a poem? I'm going to show you that while it seems simple to answer that, you'll find that you get into a great deal of difficulty. Let me start with, I'm going to read you the poems of a very minor poet, because we won't at that point have to suffer over the difficulty of whether the poems have much merit. Obviously, if you start with prose that has huge merit, you can begin to argue that it is a poem. And I don't want to go in that direction at all. I'd rather go in the other direction of taking poems that start off and they're not too good, but at least they follow Pound's principles, and go a step or two further until we get into what's obviously each time less and less of a poem, until maybe we can come to that marvelous moment where we can say definitively, this is not a poem. This is so bad, this is so simple, this is so stupid, it can't possibly be a poem. All right, now there's one that we'll start with that, as I say, these poems are all, with one exception, are going to be, the exception being the last poem, are going to be by a minor poet, so there will not be any problem with the merit. It's just that they all follow Pound's prescription, which is that they should be the equal of good prose, no slavishness to rhyme, and no more music than the occasion warrants in the sound scheme of the poem. My flesh must smell like an old tire. My sex is bitter and gone. My days are leafless and all sleep, said the housewife, going to the specialist. One knows what kind. But in the waiting room, she was racked by a plague from the pots of the American miasma, our magazines. And so Lady murmured too quietly, even for her mind to hear, Reader's Digest, please save your soul and leave mine free to contemplate eternity, which must be more than I glimpse for myself now, an endless promenade across a field of baked old beans, a cataract of dishwater, regurgitated by the memory of champagne I never drank and kings I never kissed. Well, it's a reasonable poem. It certainly obeys Pound's prescriptions. It's serious, it's tender, it's nothing remarkable, but on the other hand, it's decent. It's still, probably by general consensus, not too many would argue, not too many would say that it's out of the province of poetry. But now let's go a little further. Now we begin to approach the danger area. It's a poem called The Adventurer. I don't mind a party that gets a little rough, but did you have to throw up in my foyer, said the lady. Despair never, said the drunk. I'll pick it up. I'll really pick it up, because I don't believe in leaving my leavings at a lady's door when she's a lady like you, you crappy old unhappy bag of an armpit. Anyone ever say you're beautiful, said the drunk as he fell on his nose. Tried to kiss Lady and her fortune. Well, we do have a problem. It's the poet claimed it was a poem. It's funny, that's undeniable. It's prosy. It's concentrated, that pertains to poetry. It's curious. It tells you a great deal in a short space, but we certainly are on the edge of poetry. Let's look at something that's even further down this odd road. I was hysterical, stated the girl. I dropped my goddamn contact lens down the drain. Then this creep called at 4 a.m. Hello, kooky, said. Guess what? I just found your contact lens. Well, there's an operative metaphor that goes through it. And there's a faint hint of a rhyme, a drain, an AM. But it does suggest that we're going far afield. It makes one nervous. It's full of perturbation for me. Can that be a poem? I'd say yes, it probably is a poem given the liberty that Pound gave. Pound gave the notion. Here's a very short one. Rip the prisons open, put the convicts on television. That's very short for a poem, but but there, poetry is also irony, and it bears a certain, a certain euphoric relation to advertising. You know, rip the prisons open and put the convicts on television. Here we're getting even thinner out. Cheerleader. She went to Southern Baptist U, but somehow she never did find out who John the Baptist was. And coming down still further, Cafe Society. It always ruins a meal to walk half a block. Nonetheless, there's a recognition. Without the title, it would not be a poem. It always ruins a meal to walk half a block. Well, you're dealing with someone who weighs a great deal, or you're dealing with someone who's very old, or you're dealing with a crank, or you're just dealing with someone who's desperately opinionated or eccentric. But then you put the title on, Cafe Society, and you realize, oh, no, it's a way of life. So since it gives you this much in a few lines, you can say, well, perhaps, yes, it's still on the margin of poetry. But now I'll give you a poem by someone else that may establish our beachhead on what is not a poem. I got up in the morning. I brushed my teeth. I went out. That's it. No title. So I said, all right, that finally is not a poem. That's not even good prose. It's dull, it's repetitive, it's deadening. There's no way that it could be a poem. But what if I tell you that it was written by Robert Lowell? Then you say, well, Lowell was obsessed with the death of certain states of living consciousness. I got up, I brushed my teeth, I went out the door. It speaks of the terrible beginning of a dreadfully dull day. Madness lurks if days like that. I can tell you to your vast relief that the last remark was a lie. Robert Lowell did not write that. But we were all obliged for one horrible stretch of 40 or 50 seconds to contemplate the possibility. Or many of you were. I think there probably are a few people in the house who are so confident of their knowledge of poetry that they said to themselves, never, he never wrote that. I don't know where Mailer got the idea. The point of that last is that the authority of the speaker and the authority of history, to wit, Robert Lowell is undeniably a great poet, a major poet, created the belief that if it's said that he wrote it, then there must be a good poem there. In painting, you can find this much more easily. There's a famous story about Robert Rauschenberg and Wilhelm de Kooning. Many years ago, about 30 years ago, Rauschenberg, with de Kooning's permission, de Kooning gave Rauschenberg a pastel. And then Rauschenberg, with de Kooning's agreement, perhaps even his connivance, erased it. Just erased the pastel, and then wrote on the bottom, pastel by Wilhelm de Kooning, erased by Robert Rauschenberg. And they sold it. At that point, I think what they were trying to show is that painting had come to a most peculiar place in the history of culture. It had become an authority in and of itself. It can now be said that you could sell something with the name of the painter. And that meant that the painter was now able to write money. So you come to a notion that's at the heart of the problem, which is that authority imprinted upon emptiness is money. And if we could just settle on that, we might have a guide to keep us away from meretricious art and meretricious authority. But the collateral problem, which brings us to the second approach, the second attempt to explore into a little bit of the nature of writing, let's say, rather than the problem of writing, the nature of writing, is that that same authority, that same sense of authority, that sense of authority within oneself that says, I want to make art, whether it be painting, writing, music, or acting, but that same private sense of authority is applied to that hollow within oneself, that curious meditative calm that we think of as the psyche and reflection. And out of that comes art, when it's good. And therapy, and a curious bolstering of the ego for a short period when it's bad. So we then get into a problem that's closer to my heart, which is the difficulty of the novelist. Because the novelist lives in a simpler and more direct relation to these problems. Not everybody wants to be a poet. Practically everybody that you meet sooner or later confesses to you that they have a book they wish to write. And nothing could be more natural, because it seems to me that every day of our lives we are amending the book of our lives. That in fact, I would almost assume that it's a natural psychological need and even a property of the brain to be writing one's own private great novel, not on paper, but within one's unconscious, laying out the vast charts of one's experience, because it's those charts, those unwritten charts, but firmly glimpsed by the unconscious, that we navigate by. In life, when a major problem comes up, we draw upon the knowledge we've gained up to that point and seek to set our course by it. And so in the course of that, we naturally arrive at a recognition of what a vast novel we each have within us, that story of our life, that changing story of our life. And we want to write books. Since my first story was published when I was still in college, close to 40 years ago, I've been accustomed to thinking of myself ever since as a writer. And because I am one, strangers are always saying to me, I too would have liked to be an author. And they think of the freedom of the life, because it's a marvelous life in a certain fashion. There's no boss to face. There's no rush to work. And if you receive any renown for it, you have all the pleasures, the curious pleasures of celebrity. I understand, obviously, then, why people want to write. But all the same, another part of me is ready to laugh. And I feel like a veteran prize fighter who hears a kid say in a squeaky voice, boy, I'd like to sock that bully in the nose. The kid does not know how many years of discipline and dull punishment go into the ability to throw a commanding punch at will. I even say to myself, they write a good letter, so they believe they're ready to tell the story of their lives. They do not understand how long it takes to pick up the rudiments. Usually, if I think the person is a little serious, I'll say gently, well, it's at least as hard to learn to write as to play the piano. Then if the only reason they wanted to be a writer was to gather in some quick fame, they would get depressed, and that was okay with me. One should never encourage people to write for too little. It is a splendid life if you think only of its emoluments. But it is death to the soul if you're not good at it. I'd like to talk to you here about how much is bad about being a writer. And you may feel less sorrow if you therefore never get around to discovering whether you're talented enough to tell your tale. Because you will at least have escaped the abominable moral pressure of being a professional writer. The thing is that soon after you finish a work, if you're successful enough to know you're going to be published, The reviews come in. The reviews are murderous. Let's contrast the author's reception to the actors. Theater critics do not often try to kill performers. There must be some unspoken agreement that humans, so sensitive as thespians, have to be protected against the perils of first nights. After all, the actor is facing rejection as fearful as a major wound. A hole in the ego can be as bad as a hole in the heart. But this moderation does not carry over into literary criticism. Meretricious, dishonest, labored, loathsome, pedestrian, hopeless, disgusting, hideous, raunchy, ill-wrought. They're crushing words, but not the least uncommon to find in a review. You'd be hard put to find another professional field where criticism is equally savage. Accountants, lawyers, engineers, or doctors do not speak of one another in that way. Yet the worst of it is that this literary practice may even be fair. Harsh, if you happen to catch it yourself, but fair. You prepare a book in the safety of the study, after all. So long as you do not publish, you are secure. Nobody short of your self-esteem, your bills, or your editor is asking you to show a thing. You put your book out, if you can afford to take the time, only when it is ready. Should economic necessity force you to write faster than is good for the work, well, everybody has a sad story. But as a practical matter, not that much has to be written on the side of a cliff. An author can usually do his stint comfortably at the desk, not too hungry, and suffering no pains greater than the empty sheet of paper. That pad can look as blank as a television screen when the station is off the air. But still the writer, unlike more active creative artists, is in no immediate danger. Why should it not be open season then when the work comes out? If authors were to have it sizably better than actors in all ways, there'd be a tendency for actors to disappear and authors to multiply. But small chance of that. The critics keep our numbers down. In fact, not many talented writers remain productive through the decades. There are too many other hazards as well. Washed in and out of fashion, it is natural to see each drop from popularity as the death of one's career. And even in the most confident years of working life, there's always the little terror. Does it all stop tomorrow? Writing is spooky. There are no routines of an office to keep you going. Only the white page each morning. And you can never be certain of the source of your words, those divine words. So one's professionalism is fragile. It never becomes automatic to tell yourself that fashions pass and history is a belly dancer who will bump her belly at you again. Not easy to learn the necessary stoicism to endure in the literary world when one begins as an oversensitive adolescent. Nor is it easy to count on luck when so often it is pessimism itself that gives force to a writer's themes. Somehow, maybe it is no more than blind will, some authors stay at it. Over and over, they learn how to keep on writing a book and do it in the knowledge that it will probably be savaged on its publication and not able to fight back. An occasional critic may be singled out for counterattack or a letter written to the editor of a book section. But such efforts of self-defense are like rifle fire against bombardment. The equation is clear. The writer sits in all his power before his desk. Thereby, he is entitled to few rights on the public stage. His courage, if he has any, will come from living with the slow bruises left by the comments on his books. His spiritual skin may go slack or harden to leather, but the honor of his effort to live down bad reviews and write again has to be analogous to the unspoken and unremarked courage of people who dwell in the depression of a long illness and somehow solve enough of their inmost problems to get better. It's equal to saying that you cannot become a professional writer and keep active for 3 or 4 decades unless you learn to live with the first condition of your existence, which is that serious book reviewing is close to merciless. So the conviction that this is fair has to take root deep enough to bear analogy to the psychology of a peasant who farms a slope and takes it for granted that he was meant to work through the years with one foot standing higher than the other. Every good author who forges a long career for himself must be able, therefore, to build a personality that can stay relatively untouched by a bad reception. That takes art. Few writers have rugged personalities when they are young. In adolescence, they seldom look like potential beauty contest winners or show promise of being future All-Americans. They're most likely to be found on the sidelines, beginning to cook up that warped, passionate, bitter, transcendent vision of life that will bring them later to the attention of the American public, but only later. The young writer usually starts as a loser, and so is obliged to live with the conviction that the world he knows had better be wrong, or he is wrong. On the answer depends his estimate of his real right to survive. Thanks to greed, plastics, media, and various abominations of technology, lo, the world is wrong. The paranoid aim of the cockeyed young writer has as much opportunity to hit the target as the beauty queen's wide-eyed lack of paranoia. Occasionally, this loser of a young writer, therefore, can end up a winner. For a while, his vision has pulled him forward. He's just enough ahead of his time. But dependably, that wretched, lonely act of writing will drive him back. There's simply too much commotion in one's unfinished psyche. That is the other side of the difficulty. It is the pressure within. It is hard to explain such disturbance to people who do not write. They do not understand that in his study, a writer often does feel godlike. He's ensconced in judgment on other people's lives. He'd contemplate the fellow who does this. He could be hungover and full of the small shames and schemes of what he did yesterday or what he did 10 years ago. The failures of his life, those retinal flashes of amatory, economic, aesthetic, or parental lapses, wait like ghosts in the huge house of his empty, middle-aged self. Sometimes the ghosts even appear and have to be laid to rest. Consciously or unconsciously, a writer is obliged to make a new peace with the past. Every day he tries to write. The requirement is that he must rise above despising himself, or he will never find the sanction to peer like God into the doings of other people, render judgment on them, and so in effect tell other people how to live. Yet he must not tolerate any good news either. At the writing table, he should not come to like himself too much. If wonderfully agreeable memories appear on certain mornings, and they have nothing to do with the work, they must be banished, or they will feed one's mania and leave the writer too cheerful, too energetic, too forgiving, too horny. It is in the calm depression of a good judge that the scribblings have to cover the page. Indeed, much in the way a decent judge can feel that he has injured society by giving an unfair verdict, so does an author have to ask himself if he is fair enough to his characters. For if an author does violate the life of someone he is writing about, that is, proceeds in the continuing panic of trying to keep a book amusing, to distort his characters into more comic, more corrupt, or more evil forms than they deserve, then he is subtly injuring the reader. That is a moral crime. Few authors are innocent of it, nor can they be found not guilty of softening their portraits. Novelists don't like to destroy half the sympathy their readers may feel for a charming heroine by the admission that she shrieks at her children. Sales fly out the window. It takes as much literary integrity to be tough, therefore, as to be fair. Either way, it is difficult to keep your literary standards through the long, slogging reaches in the middle of a book when the first pleasure of conception is no longer there to sustain you, only the tides of habit, the dry breath of discipline, and the knowledge that on the other side of the hill, critics, who also have their talent to express, are waiting. It's not hard to come to the conclusion that if you're going to survive, you would better, when it comes to your own work, become the profoundest critic of them all. There is a saying among boxers that the punch you see coming hurts less than the one you did not see. An author who would find the resources to keep writing from one generation to the next does well to be the first to see every flaw in his work. Otherwise, he will never be able to decide its true merits. Let yourself be aware, however, of your book's lacks, its shortcuts, its gloss where courage could have produced a little real shine, and you can take the bad reviews. You can even tell when the critic is not effectively exposing the rotten parts of your psyche so much as he is turning his own dirty pockets out. It proves amazing how many evil reviews one can devour if there's the confidence that one has done one's best on a book, written it to the limit of one's honesty, even scraped off a little of one's dishonesty. Get to that point of purity, and your royalties may be hurt by a small welcome, but not your ongoing working morale. There's even firm hope. If the book is better than its reception, then history, that torch singer, may find you another ditty in years to come. The prescription, therefore, is simple. Learn not to put out a job that has a serious element of the meretricious. Or maybe it is more accurate to say the prescription will be simple, except that we all put out work of which we are, in fact, a bit ashamed, a matter of degree. There's that remark of Engels to Marx. Quantity changes quality. A single potato is there to eat, but 10,000 potatoes are a commodity and have to be put in bins or boxes. A profit must be made from them, or a loss will most certainly be taken. In kind, a little corruption in a book is as natural as the author's style, but a sizable literary delinquency is like a diseased organ. At least so we'll feel if the critics begin to bang on it and happen to be right for once. That will be the hour when your creditors do not go away. So does the fear back of the writing on every book. When I think, therefore, of that life I've spent trying to learn how to write and how to take pride in my peculiarly lonely craft, I still feel the same young fear any adolescent knows before such a test. Am I good enough? Can I do honest work? And then I have to smile. From one way, I'm like the stranger who asked me about writing because he or she wants to sit down and find a way to tell the secret story of their own incredible life. I'm equal to that stranger. I've been writing for 40 years and should know a lot about it, and I do. Yet I'm still getting up my nerve to take a deep breath and tell the only primal story that any of us ever have, the true story of my own life and its own curious turns and all its private parts. There is probably no fear so great as to look in the mirror and begin to write. I think at this point we might be ready for a few questions. You will gather that the brunt of these remarks has been to discourage you from becoming a writer. And for good purpose, as a wise man said to me years ago, also a writer, he said, "It's good that a lot of people know how to read, but what happens, they also learn how to write, and there are too many writers around." I didn't mean, however, to depress you fatally. I'll take any question, the ruder the better. All right, the question that was asked, if you didn't hear it in the back, was if when you wake up in the morning and you face that blank piece of paper, what do you do if you don't feel like writing? Is that fair? And it's the only bit of universal advice I have to give young writers, which is you face it. And if you can't write for 20 days, you go in there for 20 days and you face it every day for 3 or 4 hours and you suffer. But what happens, and this is a hard notion to get across to the young, but I do believe firmly by now that the unconscious prepares the work for the next day. Even if we're going to take the theory of the deconstructionists and assume it's the demiurge who does the writing for us and we're just the agent of it, even the demiurge has to trust you. So you have to demonstrate to your unconscious that if it prepares the work, you're going to be there to deliver it. And generally when you don't feel like writing, it's for one of two reasons. Either what you're going to be writing about is too painful and too close to you and it's likely to upset your notion of yourself. And one goes into all the psychological pits that are possible there. And in that sense, if it's true, if it's really going to unbalance your ability to use that terrible word to function, then you may not be able to write at all. But the other reason, which often is a happier reason, is just simply that the unconscious doesn't trust you because the last time it started to give you a good story that took 3 days to write, you got so excited that the story was good on the first or second night that you went out and got dead drunk. And on the last day, you couldn't finish it because your head was shattered. And once the unconscious has gone through that, it tends to be like an animal that's whipped. And that the reason one goes in every day to work is simply that you have to get your unconscious to trust you again. And if you demonstrate to it every day that you're there, suited up, ready to go into the game and play, finally it may trust you. In other words, if they're not deep psychological disturbances for not wanting to write, then the only other reason would be that you have to get in touch with yourself enough so that your unconscious will trust you and believe that you're serious about writing. The flaws of my writing? Well, that'd be a very long book, and I never sat down to write it. I think when I say you have to be your own toughest critic, you have to be that on a day-to-day basis. That is, each day when you're writing, you truly have to come to grips with what you probably didn't do that day and digest it. Because finally, if you're working on a novel day after day after day, there's a tendency to recognize that you have to do your best each day and not brood upon it over long. But on the other hand, you mustn't ever give yourself the notion that you're writing better than you are, because that leads to all kinds of pitfalls. The first of which is this: the one thing you can't be when you're writing is manic, because if you are, the words start to look too good. Many of you probably have written, most kids who write their first short story write it about falling in love, and they come home and they write, and he sat down and he looked at her. "I love you," he said. At that point, everything that happened the previous night comes back to him, and he feels huge emotion. He thinks, "What a great writer I am." You think, and the reader sees it and says, "I love you." And they go, "Oh God!" And, so it's you have to find that peculiar calm in which you work. The only thing peculiar about it is not that it's a peculiar calm; it's just that it's peculiar that you can find the calm day after day. You never expect to. You really have to. Long before I'd ever heard about meditation, all those various exercises that you use to empty your mind and prepare yourself, I was doing it, as every writer does in one form or another, when they're sharpening pencils, which is the old joke, how many pencils do you sharpen before you start work? That's the way in which you empty the mind and have a, a personal meditation before you begin to work to find that calm.
You once said that as a novelist, you felt as qualified as a psychoanalyst to understand human nature.
Yes. I now feel more qualified. What?
You said that before the Jack Abbott affair. Do you still feel that now afterwards? Do you think the best...
Well, I look.
Can understand human nature the way the best psychoanalyst might.
Yes, but look, I don't want to make jokes about the Jack Abbott business at all. I do want to say this, though, that there was a true failure of acumen on my part and understanding of the depth of the problem. No question. But in all seriousness, there have been great psychoanalysts who had, and I'm not comparing myself here, but there are great psychoanalysts who've had tragic results with some of their patients. You can be a wonderful psychoanalyst and the patient can commit suicide. That happens. Very often it happens because the analyst may have made a bold decision to take a great many chances with the patient. You see, on the theory that if he didn't, the result was going to be years and years and years of the most pervasive depression and misery. That the patient, in effect, was not only going to be poisoning their own life, but poisoning the life of everyone around, including the psychoanalyst, who had to face this depressed patient every day, 5 days a week for the next 7 years. So the analyst became wicked. That is, the analyst upped the ante. The analyst pushed it a little faster, perhaps, than was absolutely safe, and lost. Now, that doesn't mean that was a bad analyst. It just means that it was an analyst who, like any other human, had made an error. I wouldn't compare myself to that analyst because, since we've gotten into the Abbott business, I would just say that the guilt I feel is not that... I got him out of jail, I alone, because a great many people got him out of jail, including the Utah Parole Board. The guilt I feel is that I didn't spend more time with him once he got out. I mean, I knew deep down that he was a huge responsibility and that he was a man that needed a guide just to explain the life outside to him. And I had my own work at the time, and I kept looking for favorable signs with Jack Abbott and saying, gee, the guy's really coming around the bend. He's doing all right. He's going to make it. And I walked away from the problem, and that's the guilt I feel. But the fact that Jack Abbott was going to have a tough time on the outside was certainly no question to me. I knew he was. I was surprised when he got out that fast. I thought he'd probably be getting out in a year or two, but he got out fast, and his book came out at the same time. And when that happened, I knew there was going to be terrible trouble, because you take a perfectly sane or relatively sane young first novelist, and their book comes out, and they're half crazy. That doesn't mean that I may not know as much as... analyst. I mean, that's my vanity, if you will. I don't ask you to accept it. It's just my private notion of it. And I think the only reason is analysts might have far better instincts for understanding people immediately in many situations. But the nature of psychoanalysis as a working profession is not one that encourages much meditation on human nature. Willy-nilly, given the hours, they end up becoming psychic mechanics, even the good ones. Yeah, why haven't there been 50 Freuds since Freud? Is that something that hits you much more when you're young? Because then you're trying to publish a short story, or if you start off as a commercial writer, and some good writers have started that way, although I honestly don't recommend it. You know, but very often you start off, let's say, writing magazine feature pieces. You go shopping around, and then the commercial aspects of the piece are not even determined by you. They're determined by the editor, who, if he ends up liking your work, will say, here, what do you think of doing a story on this? Can you do it? And so on. But later, what you do is you just hope you never get into a situation where you're writing a book just for money. You know, you hope that what you'll get is something that's truly interesting to you and also offers a good sum of money. You look for the balance between the two. I used to write for the public because I thought there was something they had to be told. And as I've gotten older and I've made more mistakes, I've gotten more modest, and now I try to write more for myself. I find there's actually, as a practical matter, there's no difference as far as history is concerned, because you never know the effects of your work. You can think you're writing something for the public that's going to move them in a given direction, but usually all you're doing at that point is writing badly. Because if you're too aware of what you think is right, the odds are very great that you're wrong. And, you know, given the complexity of the kind of things that good writers try to write about, what you hope for more than telling the public what to think is that you can create a certain resonance in your work that will evoke mood in your readers. I feel something's good when I will get 12 different reactions, all going in different directions from what I've written, but the reactions are full of energy. Well, then I feel I must have done something that's agreeable or at the least resonant, because everyone has been stimulated by the work. When you tend to have people think in a given direction, there's a big tendency to be manipulating them, and then you're just writing ideology, and it doesn't usually work. Well, the questions are terrific, but I think I want to bring us to a close with a thought. We've been talking about writing from that most special position of the poet, arriving at no firm conclusions other than the absolute difficulty of certainty in the finest kinds of writing. We talked a little about the curious difficulties of being a writer. I'd like to talk about the visionary aspects for just a moment. The president of France, François Mitterrand, invited about 100 writers and intellectuals over to France, over to Paris, about a month ago. He made a curious and startling and rather wonderful remark. He said that the economists of the world no longer understood the economic problems of the world, and so he was inviting the world's intellectuals and artists to come to Paris to help with the problem. Now, the conference as such was agreeable and interesting, and it was like any convention. You met a great many people that you'd wanted to meet for a long time, and it was cordial and courteous and hospitable, and all that was fine. And I can't begin to tell you what, if anything, was developed there, because my French wasn't good enough and broke down seriously in the course of the of listening to many speeches in French. Since it's very hard to keep listening to the simultaneous translation, you'll have a big ruddy fellow up there talking, and you've got a tired lady with several children waiting for her to come home and take care of them and cook the supper, and she's having to give the translation. And it's so so curious, so strained, that after a while your ear breaks down and you pull off the earphone and you listen to the French of the ruddy fellow, and that you can't follow it altogether. So I really don't know what was said there. I would guess that no profound solutions were found in those 2 days. What I was startled by, however, was the reaction of the American press. They hated that conference. They loathed it. They were furious. They were indignant beyond belief. You know, we all are marvelously tolerant of and cynical about the wonderful freedoms of our politicians. You know, we'll say, oh, well, he's just pulling off a circus. He's got to please his constituents. Well, you know, why doesn't Mitterrand have the same right to pull off an intellectual circus for socialists as we have to have a Super Bowl that the president attends for right-wingers in America? The point, though, is when I came back, and if you remember, the criticism was really outraged. You know, George Will, that macho wimp, Couldn't have been more beside himself. The notion that writers could have something to say about economic problems seemed to him to be a perfect example of the adulteration of the purity of the streams. But, you know, I started to ponder it, and it seemed to me that there's a great deal to it potentially. Because, and this is the thought I'd like to leave you with, it seemed to me that maybe there was more collaboration, more similarity, more similitude between the great economists and the great and even the good novelists than there is between the great economists and the economic experts. Because if you think about some of the truly great economists, like Marx, like Adam Smith, I'd say they have more in common with Stendhal and Tolstoy than they do with the men who, you know, let's say with that very intelligent man, Mr. Stockman. And the reason for it is that the great economists were always working to find a vision of human society. And they would ponder the interchanges of human energy and look for those means and ways, institutionally, that human energy would be augmented or would be dissipated or even destroyed. All of Das Kapital can be seen as a phenomenological novel in which the protagonist is a commodity, a little tin can, or whatever commodity you wish it to be, that enters on the first page, and this commodity goes through unbelievable metamorphoses and transmogrifications. It has an extraordinarily vital life as a protagonist. You can look at The Red and the Black, and you can see it as a study in the augmentation and dissipation of human energy in the protagonist, Julian Sorrell, and in all the other people. We can think of any number of great novels that are studies precisely in how people gain and lose energy. And finally, in economics, beneath everything else, there is that common bond to the novel, which is what is trying to find a vision of life that will comprehend the ways in which we increase our possibilities or destroy them. And so, let me conclude on this thought. I think that Mitterrand, who bears this most striking, odd, offbeat resemblance to André Gide, may have hit upon something, and that we will yet find the now virtually moribund, or at least not well-functioning notions of economics, revivified in years to come by some magnificent writer, perhaps not yet born, who will transcend the categories and write some work that will marry all those visions of society that have to do with how we offer each other human energy and steal it from one another, augment it, and divert it. And we will be face to face again with a vision that will make our existence perhaps seem to us a touch closer to the viable. Thank you.